Our scripture reading today is Ephesians 6. So if you have your Bible, I invite you to turn there with me. Ephesians 6, and I'll be reading verses 5 through 9. Ephesians 6, 5 through 9. Verse 5, slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly as unto the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. This morning I want to talk to you about the gospel and your work life. How does the gospel affect the way you work? We don't tend to think of the gospel and the and our jobs as having much to do with each other. I mean, the gospel is about Jesus and it's about spirituality. That's what we talk about when we come to church. And then our work is what we do the other days of the week. It's what we do to make money. But do the two really have, you know, much to do with each other? And that's what I want to talk about this morning because they do. The gospel has a lot to inform about how we see our work, how we see our occupations. And Paul gives us some counsel on that, and so that's what I want to focus on this morning. But as I was preparing the sermon this week on this particular text and on the topic of work, it became pretty clear to me that in order to hear anything I say about work and the gospel, that there's one thing I'm going to have to address first, and that is the way this passage begins. It begins with these words, slaves, obey your masters. When we hear those words, immediately red flags go up in our mind. Those were words that were used right out of the Bible by slave owners and slave sympathizers here in America to justify slavery. What do we do with those? They're in our scripture. They're in our Bible. And people look at those words today and they say, look, the Bible condones slavery. And, you know, critics use it to say, therefore, obviously the Bible is out of touch. It's out of touch with what's moral, and we can't really trust the Bible today. You know, it's irrelevant. And a lot of us Christians are really uncomfortable with these words. They're in our Bible. And what we want to do is just skip over them and hope that nobody notices them, and let's talk about better stuff. And we really hope our kids don't read these words, because how do you explain it to your kids? Slaves, obey your masters. What do you say about that? And when faced with what the critics say, we don't know how to respond. You know, it's right there. How do you respond to that? And so what do you say about a Bible that condones slavery, or at least appears to? So we need to talk about that part first. When you hear the word slave, what image comes into your mind? I think for almost everybody here, because we live on this side of the slave trade that existed in the United States, there's a picture that comes to our mind when we hear the word slave. It's a picture of a black person who was kidnapped from their homeland in Africa, completely taken against their will, put on a ship in deplorable conditions, taken to either Europe or the United States, where they were then auctioned to the highest bidder, and then had to spend the rest of their life working, treated like an animal, and that's all that life was. And that's what the next generation, that's what their children had to look forward to. I mean, there's a reason why slavery is called America's original sin, because it was so inhumane, it was so immoral. It was a complete rejection of the whole concept that all humans are created in the image of God. It was a rejection of that idea, of that truth. And it's a truth of history that in the mid-1800s, slave owners and slave sympathizers used the Bible and used this passage right here, "Slaves, obey your masters," to justify slavery. Look, Paul says it's okay. Paul says, "Slaves, obey your masters," so it's got to be okay. And there's no way that we can get around the fact that that is what happened. The Bible was used that way. But it's also a truth of history that this same book that was used to justify slavery was also the source of the abolitionist movement. Do you know who started the abolition movement? It was primarily Quakers and evangelical Christians who read this book and said, slavery is wrong, slavery is immoral, and we have to do something, that we've got to stop it. And so this book was used both to justify and to abhor slavery. Now here's the question. If 19th century Christians rose up based on what they read in the Bible and said slavery is wrong, if 19th century Christians did that, why didn't first century Christians do that? Why didn't Paul do that? Why didn't Paul, because it's so obvious that slavery, why didn't Paul do that? It's so obvious that it's wrong. That's the question. If it happened in the 19th century, why didn't Christians do that in the first century? And a big part of why it didn't happen in the first century is this, that slavery in the 19th century and slavery in the first century Greco-Roman time were two very different animals, two very different things. Not saying that slavery in the first century was a good thing, but it was very different from what we understand slavery from our U.S. history to have been. For one thing, slavery in the first century, it was not race-based. It had nothing to do with your race. Second of all, you didn't become a slave by being kidnapped. For the most part, you became a slave in the first century when your country went to war and you lost the war. Then if you were a soldier, you often were then taken by the country that defeated you. You were then taken and you served as a slave. But slavery also was not a lifetime thing in the first century like it was here in America. Most slaves served for 10, maybe 15 years, and then they were set free. Also, slaves in the first century actually had rights. In the first century, if you were a slave, you could actually take your master to the court of that day if you had a complaint against him. So you had some limited rights. In fact, if you were a slave, you could even own other slaves. And slaves could own property. So slavery in the first century was not the same thing as what we think of here in America. And I'm not saying that slavery in the first century was a good thing. I'm just saying it was a very different thing. And so when we hear these words where Paul says, "Slaves, obey your masters," we have to understand what Paul's talking about. Paul's not talking to 19th century people who are kidnapped from Africa and enslaved for life and treated immorally. It's my opinion that Paul would never have said, that's a good thing, or slaves in that condition obey your masters, because it was so obviously immoral. I mean, kidnapping in and of itself, right there, that clearly makes it immoral. Can't believe that Paul would in any way condone that. Now, it is a fact of history that the first century Christian church was filled with slaves and servants. And the question is, why would slaves and servants flood into the first century Christian church? Why would they all congregate there? And the answer is because the gospel and the words of Paul gave them something that they couldn't find anywhere else in society. What Christianity gave to slaves in the first century gave their lives more meaning and value. It gave them a way to deal with the crushing weight of being a slave. It gave their life a certain amount of dignity. And so in spite of all the difficulties of being a slave, they found something in the gospel that lightened their load, that gave them dignity as human beings. It's interesting because Greco-Roman writers back in the first century, they used to write what were called household codes. Household codes were basically codes given to members of a household on how they should conduct themselves. And so a household code would have conduct for husbands and wives. It would have conduct for parents and children. And it would have conduct for slaves and masters. And in fact, what all the commentators point out is that in the book of Ephesians, in chapters 5 and 6, that's exactly what Paul is giving us here, or giving them, was a household conduct code. Because if you look at Ephesians 5, beginning at chapter 22, he talks to wives and husbands. And then beginning in chapter 6, he talks to children and parents. And then beginning in verse 5, he talks to slaves and masters. He's giving them a conduct code. And all the commentators point this out. They say when the Greco-Roman writers would write these conduct codes, they would never speak to the slaves in the conduct codes. They would never address the slaves directly. They would only address the masters, because their attitude was, if you want to have good conduct in a household, why talk to a slave? If you want to have good conduct, talk to the master. Tell the master what he should do, how the house should be run. You know, slaves just, they're supposed to do what they're told. You talk to the master. And what's revolutionary here is that in Paul's conduct code in the book of Ephesians, he addresses the slaves directly. In fact, he addresses the slaves before he addresses the masters. And he has more to say to the slaves than he does to the masters. And it's hard for us to appreciate how revolutionary this was, but it really was. Paul was doing what you didn't do in that day, which was treat a slave with dignity and respect by addressing them directly, by even addressing them before you addressed the master. But that's what Paul is doing here. And especially, I want you to notice what Paul says in Ephesians 6, 9. He's talking to the masters here. He says, masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Treat your slaves in the same way. Well, the question is, what is the same way? What does that mean? What same way is he talking about? Well, if you read earlier in Ephesians 5 and 6, he keeps talking about with fear and respect. Fear and respect. In other words, Paul is saying to the masters, you must respect your slaves. And then the very next phrase he says, and do not threaten them. Do not threaten your slaves. Again, you didn't write these kind of things. Seneca, who was one of the great Roman writers of that time, his famous line was, you always treat your slaves as enemies. Because slaves only know fear and power. And so you treat your slaves as enemies because that's what they know. That's what they'll respond to. And Paul's saying, no, don't treat them as enemies. Don't threaten them. Treat them with respect. And then Paul says in the last part of verse 9, he says, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. Basically, Paul is saying, by the way, masters, you're slaves too. You're slaves of the master in heaven, and you're both slaves of him. Basically, he's putting the masters on equal ground with the slaves. So you're equal to them in the eyes of God. God doesn't look at you any different just because you're a master. He doesn't look at you as any better than the slaves that you have. In fact, he says, there is no favoritism with him. There is no favoritism with God. Don't think that because you're a master, you're anything special. Now, like I said, it's hard for us to appreciate how revolutionary this was in that day, but it was. You just didn't write these kinds of things. And what we need to understand is Paul's objective here was neither to condone nor to condemn slavery in the first century. What his objective was is to write to people who are living in those conditions and say, here's what you do. Here's what the gospel would have you to do in the condition that you're in. Here's how you deal with the situation you're in right now. But here's what we need to know. Even though Paul did not outright condemn slavery, the result of his words were that slavery over time ceased to exist in the Christian church. Slaves or Christians over time ceased to hold slaves precisely because of what Paul said. I want to read to you the words of F.F. Bruce, who's one of the premier theologians in the 20th century. He says this, "The words of Paul brought people into a situation in which even that moderate kind of slavery practiced in the first century could only wilt and die." In other words, the attitudes that Paul demanded of Christian slaveholders, to treat the slaves with dignity, to treat them with respect, to realize that in the eyes of God, you are no different than your slave, you're no better than your slave. Eventually, those words caused slavery in the first century to disappear from the Christian church. And we know as a fact of history that that's exactly what happened. So, when Paul says, slaves, obey your masters, he's not talking to slaves in America the way we know slavery to have been. That's not who he's talking to. Now, here's the question. Okay, so fine. Paul was talking to slaves in the first century Greco-Roman world. But what relevance are his words to those slaves, to me, in 21st century America? I'm not a slave. I get paid for my work. So what could Paul say to them that in any way applies to me? Because I'm not a slave. Back in the 70s, there was a guy by the name of Studs Terkel. Any of you ever heard of Studs Terkel? Any of you ever going to name your kids Studs? I don't know what the parents were thinking. Maybe that was a nickname, but that was his name, Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel wrote a book simply called Working. And you read it, Mike? The premise of the book was pretty simple. All he did was just interview people here in the United States about their work life. And then he recorded basically the results of all these interviews that he had with hundreds of people who worked here in the United States. And I want you to hear what he says in the introduction to his book. This is about work life in America. This is what he says. He says, "This book, being about work, is by its very nature about violence. Violence to the spirit as well as to the body. It is about ulcers as well as accidents, about shouting matches as well as fistfights, about nervous breakdowns as well as kicking the dog. It is, above all, about daily humiliations. To survive the workday is triumph enough for the walking wounded among the great many of us. What Studs Terkel is saying is that even though we don't practice slavery right now in America, even though we don't see ourselves as slaves, work is still difficult. Work is still drudgery. People still experience work as difficult, as oppressive. And some people experience work every day that is that way. Maybe some of you experienced work this week that was that way, that was difficult, that was grinding, that made you want to come home and kick the dog, that was humiliating. All work to a certain degree is that way. Work wears us down. Even if you get paid lots of money for the work you do, it can still wear you down. It can still tax your body, and it can still tax your spirit to the point where you can get sick and you can get depressed and you can go crazy. Work is still difficult, and we all know this to be true to different degrees. Work can be very dehumanizing. And so even though Paul is speaking to slaves in the first century, his words are still applicable to us today because we work, and work is still a challenge. The early Christian church, like I mentioned before, was flooded with slaves and servants, and they found something there that gave them dignity and gave them hope. Paul gave them a prescription that worked. And if it worked for them, maybe it has something to say to us as well. And the very simple principle that Paul gave to first century slaves that helped them is found in verse 7. Paul says this. He says, "Serve wholeheartedly as unto the Lord, not men." Serve wholeheartedly as unto the Lord and not unto man. What Paul is saying here is that all work is a service first and foremost to God. Not to your boss, not to your employer, but first and foremost, all your work is a service to God. It's a service to God before your manager, before whoever your boss is. What Paul is saying is that every aspect of your work life falls under the lordship of Jesus. And every part of your job is valuable in God's eyes. Now imagine what this sounded like to first century slaves. "You mean my slavery falls under the lordship of Jesus? You mean even as a slave, he is my master?" And Paul says, "Yes. You serve him first and foremost." And what this did is it elevated their dignity. And the same can be true of us, because when we realize that first and foremost our boss is God, that gives us dignity. That first and foremost we work for him, and that our work, whatever work you do, is a calling from God. Whatever line of work you're in, it is a holy calling from God. And when you see your work that way, it changes the way you approach your work. It's not just a way to make money, but in fact, it's a holy calling from God. I read a story this week about a guy named Howard Hendricks. He's a Christian preacher. And he tells about how one time he was on a flight that got delayed. And if any of you have ever been on a flight where you boarded the airplane and then the airplane didn't take off and you sit there for an hour or two, you know what it's like. It's not a pleasant scene. And the people there were sitting on the runway. The plane wasn't taking off, and they started getting really testy and really irritable. And so they started taking it out on the flight attendants. And Hendricks noticed that there was one flight attendant who, in the midst of all this with negativity and this chaos, she was really poised and really gracious, even though she wasn't being treated well. And after the flight took off, he called her over, and he said that he was really impressed by how she handled that, and he'd like to write her a letter of recommendation and send it to her boss. And she replied, she said, "Well, you need to know that I don't work for this airline. I work for Jesus Christ. And this morning, before I left the house, my husband and I prayed that somehow today, through my work, I could do something that would reflect Jesus, because he's my employer." And when we realize that first and foremost, the person we work for is God, it changes the way we see our job, even if it's a difficult one. And if you see your boss, if you see your employer first and foremost as Jesus, it'll change other things too. We all know that there's a kind of a hierarchy of importance of work, right? At the top of this hierarchy, you have people who do religious work. You have pastors, teachers, missionaries. They're at the top. And then all other work comes secondary to that, right? Yeah. And you know, here at the office, here we operate that way. Calvin and I, the pastors, we're at the top, and then Angela is below us because she's a secretary. But sometimes that's actually how we think, right? Religious work is at the top, and everything else comes secondary to that. And only pastors are called by God to the work that they do. Everyone else just chooses their employment. What you need to know is that Ephesians 6:7 totally undercuts that. Totally undercuts that. In fact, Peter O'Brien, who is a commentator on Ephesians, he says this: when Paul says, "Do your work serving the Lord," ultimately the distinction between sacred and secular work is knocked out. In other words, all work is a holy calling from God, not just religious work. And in fact, Martin Luther got a hold of this, and this was really kind of the second pillar of the Reformation. Probably many of you are familiar with the first pillar of the Reformation, which was that you are saved by grace and not by works. And this was the big battle cry of the Reformation. But there was a second battle cry. And Martin Luther, it came from what he called the priesthood of all believers. Martin Luther, as you probably know, he himself was a monk. And he was told that monks and nuns and priests, their calling was from God. And everyone else was just doing ordinary, profane work. And one day, Martin Luther read this text, Ephesians 6:7. He said, "Wait a minute. Wait a minute." And he realized that all work is a holy calling from God. There's a famous line he says in one passage. He said, "The milkmaid has as honorable a calling as the priest or the teacher." The milkmaid has as honorable a calling as the priest or the teacher. Now, here at Sunnyside, we contract with Star Cleaning, owned by Stephanie Carpenter, to clean our church. Now, let me ask you, is the cleaning work that Stephanie's crew does, is it as honorable as the preaching work that I do? Is it? You don't mean that. No, but it is, and I want to tell you why it is. Let's say that we, for whatever reason, maybe budget reasons, we decided that We don't need lesser work done around here anymore. We just need preaching, because it's the holy thing. It's the holy calling. So we let him go, and we don't clean the church. I wonder how many of you would still be coming here 6 months from now. Imagine what it would look like. Imagine what it would smell like after 6 months of not being cleaned. I read a book one time, and it was interesting because it says when new people come and they evaluate a church for the first time, what do you think they look at to make their decision about whether they want to, you know, make that church their home or not? They look at the bathrooms. And if the bathrooms are clean and kind of up to date, they say, maybe this is a place where I could belong. And so what we need to say to the cleaning crew is, you're our evangelists, okay? It matters that the place is clean. Human flourishing is important. All work is a holy calling from God, not just preaching and teaching and, you know, doing religious things. It's all a holy calling from God. And if you see your work that way, I promise you that you will begin to approach it differently. Furthermore, if you believe this principle that all work is a holy calling from God, it will affect the way you treat people as well. R.C. Sproul is a minister, and a while back he wrote a book called In Search of Dignity. And it was based on some work that he had been done, well, he had done while he was wrestling with some Bible passages. And one of them was this one, Ephesians 6:7, where he understood that all work is a holy calling from God. Another passage he was wrestling with was the one that we are all made in the image of God. Another one, Philippians 2, where it talks about how Jesus emptied himself of his heavenly glory and he came down and he came down to this earth and he died on the cross. And he was thinking about these passages and what do they mean and what's the significance of them. And while he was doing this, he went to a hospital to visit a friend of his who was sick. And he realized that in the hospital, there is a very organized caste system. And I don't say this to pick on medical people because it's not just in the medical field. But he realized there's a very strict caste system. At the top, you have your top doctors. And underneath that, there are just the other doctors. Then underneath that, you have the interns. And then underneath that, you have the hospital administrators. And then underneath that, you have the nurses. Then underneath that, you have the techs. Then underneath that, you have all the other staff. And then at the bottom, you have housekeeping. And he realized this because he observed a nurse. And she was in a conversation with a bunch of doctors. And while she was talking to the doctors, she was very attentive, very alert, looking them in the eyes, and very engaged. A minute later, she turned around and she was walking down the hallway of the hospital. And approaching her, coming the other direction, was a guy from housekeeping. And he was pushing a cart with soiled linens. He was a friendly guy. And as they came closer, he looked up to catch her gaze. And as he looked up and caught her gaze, at that moment, she looked down and passed him. And what he realized was that there is a very strict caste system. And we humans work very hard to protect our place in that hierarchy. And that hierarchy so often is based on the work that we do. The human heart is always looking for a way to get a leg up, to see ourselves as better than somebody else. And we'll find all kinds of ways to justify it and explain it away and to say it's okay, but it's not. And unless the gospel of grace comes along and just bleaches that out of us, we're going to operate that way. And so we've got to take hold of this concept that all work, not just some work, all work is a holy calling from God. God calls all kinds of people to all kinds of different places. You know, I used to work in the business world. And I left there because I felt called to do this work. And this work is more fulfilling to me than what I did in the business world. But some of you who are in the business world, if you came and did my job, you would find what happens in the business world far more fulfilling than what I do here. And it just means because you're called to that and I'm called to this. And the person who cleans the church is called to that. And the person who serves you at the restaurant is called to do that. It's not just a step to try to move up the hierarchy. And the gospel of grace is what cures us of that. Emma Daniel Gray. You ever heard of her? Emma Daniel Gray? No? She died on June 8, 2009, a little over a year ago, at the age of 95. And in her obituary, it says that she was a charwoman. You know what a charwoman is? It's a fancy word for a housekeeper. It's kind of a short way of saying a chore woman, a charwoman. You say, well, she wasn't very important. She was a housekeeper. You know, whatever you do, your job is probably more important than hers, right? And yet, there was a big write-up on her in the Washington Post after she died. Because for 24 years, she was the charwoman for 6 U.S. presidents. She cleaned the office of the U.S. president every day. And it was said of her that every day she would go up to the seat where the U.S. president sat, and before she dusted it, she would say a prayer over that seat, that man would have courage and strength and wisdom to do his job. What is it that makes your work important? Is it the work that you do, or is it the person who you serve? The gospel says it's the person who we serve. The most important part of our work is not the task itself. It's the person who we call our boss. And when we see our work, whatever it is, as serving the Lord first and not humans, it gives our life dignity and value and worth.